Henry H. Rogers, 1893-1904. Florence, spring of 1904, April. Mr. Rogers has been visiting the witness stand periodically in Boston for more than a year now. For 11 years he has been my closest and most valuable friend. His wisdom and steadfastness saved my copyrights from being swallowed up in the wreck and ruin of Charles L. Webster and Company, and his commercial wisdom has protected my pocket ever since in those lucid intervals wherein I have been willing to listen to his counsels and abide by his advice, a thing which I do half the time, and half the time I don't. He is 4 years my junior. He is young in spirit and in looks, complexion and bearing, easy and graceful in his movements, kind-hearted, attractive, winning, a natural gentleman, the best-bred gentleman I have met on either side of the ocean in any rank of life, from the Kaiser of Germany down to the bootblack. He is affectionate, endowed with a fine quality of humor, and with his intimates he is a charming comrade. I am his principal intimate, and that is my idea of him. His mind is a bewildering spectacle to me when I see it dealing with vast business complexities like the affairs of the prodigious Standard Oil Trust, the United States Steel, and the rest of the huge financial combinations of our time, for he and his millions are in them all, and his brain is a very large part of the machinery which keeps them alive and going. Many a time in the past 11 years my small and troublesome affairs have forced me to spend days and weeks of waiting time down in the city of New York, and my waiting refuge has been his private office in the Standard Oil Building, stretched out on a sofa behind his chair, observing his processes, smoking, reading, listening to his reasonings with the captains of industry, and intruding advice where it was not invited, not desired, and in no instance adopted, so far as I remember. A patient man, I can say that for him. This private office was a spacious, high-ceilinged chamber on the 11th floor of the Standard Oil Building, with large windows which looked out upon the moving life of the river with the Colossus of Liberty enlightening the world holding up her torch in the distance. When I was not there, it was a solitude, since in those intervals no one occupied the place except Mr. Rogers and his brilliant private secretary, Miss Catherine I. Harrison, who he once called in on an emergency 13 or 14 years ago from among the 750 clerks laboring for the Standard Oil in the building. She was 19 or 20 years old then, and did stenographic work and typewriting at the wage of that day, which was $15 or $20 a week. He has a sharp eye for capacity, and after trying Miss Harrison for a week, he promoted her to the post of chief of his private secretaries and raised her wages. She has held the post ever since. She has seen the building double its size and increase its clerical servants to 1,500, and her own salary climb to $10,000 a year. She is the only private secretary who sits in the sanctum. The others are in the next room and come at the bell call. Miss Harrison is alert, refined, well-read in the good literature of the day, is fond of paintings and buys them. She is a cyclopedia in whose head is written down the multitudinous details of Mr. Rogers' business. Order and system are a native gift with her. Mr. Rogers refers to her as he would to a book, and she responds with the desired information with a book's confidence and accuracy. Several times I have heard Mr. Rogers say that she is quite able to conduct his affairs substantially without his help. Necessarily, Mr. Rogers' pecuniary aid was sought by his full share of men and women without capital who had ideas for sale, ideas worth millions if their exploitation could be put in charge of the right man. Mr. Rogers' share of these opportunities was so large that if he had received and conversed with all his applicants of that order, he might have made many millions per hour, it is true, but he would not have had half an hour left in the day for his own business. He could not see all of these people, therefore he saw none of them, for he was a fair and just man. For his protection, his office was a kind of fortress with outworks, these outworks being several communicating rooms into which no one could get access without first passing through an outwork where several young colored men stood guard, and carried in the cards and requests and brought back the regrets. Three of the communicating rooms were for consultations, and they were seldom unoccupied. Men sat in them waiting, men who were there by appointment, appointments not loosely specified, but specified by the minute hand of the clock. These rooms had ground glass doors, and their privacy was in other ways protected and secured. Mr. Rogers consulted with a good many men in those rooms in the course of his day's work of 6 hours, and whether the matter in hand was small and simple or great and complicated, it was discussed and dispatched with marvelous celerity. Every day these consultations supplied a plenty of vexations and exasperations for Mr. Rogers. I know this quite well. But if ever they found revealment in his face or manner, it could have been for only a moment or two, for the signs were gone when he re-entered his private office, and he was always his brisk and cheerful self again, and ready to be chaffed and joked and reply in kind. His spirit was often heavily burdened, necessarily, but it cast no shadow, and those about him sat always in the sunshine. Sometimes the value of his securities went down by the million day after day. Sometimes they went up as fast, but no matter which it was, the face and bearing exhibited by him were only proper to a rising market. Several times every day Miss Harrison had to act in a diplomatic capacity. Men called whose position in the world was such that they could not be dismissed with the formula engaged along with Mr. Rogers's regrets, and to these Miss Harrison went out and explained pleasantly and tactfully and sent them away comfortable. Mr. Rogers transacted a vast amount of business during his 6 hours daily, but there always seemed time enough in the 6 hours for it. That Boston Gas lawsuit came on at a bad time for Mr. Rogers, for his health was poor and remained so during several months. Every now and then he had to stay in his country house at Fairhaven, Massachusetts, a week or two at a time, leaving his business in Miss Harrison's hands and conferring with her once or twice daily by long-distance telephone. To prepare himself for the witness stand was not an easy thing, but the materials for it were to be had, for Mr. Rogers never destroyed a piece of paper that had writing on it, and as he was a methodical man, he had ways of tracing out any paper he needed, no matter how old it might be. The papers needed in the gas suit, wherein Mr. Rogers was sued for several millions of dollars, went back in date a good many years and were numberable by the hundreds. But Miss Harrison ferreted them all out from the stacks and bales of documents in the Standard Oil vaults and caused them to be listed and annotated by the other secretaries. This work cost weeks of constant labor, but it left Mr. Rogers in shape to establish for himself an unsurpassable reputation as a witness. I wish to make a momentary digression here and call up an illustration of what I've been saying about Mr. Rogers's habits in the matter of order and system. When he was a young man of 24 out in the oil regions of Pennsylvania, and straitened in means, he had some business relations with another young man. Time went on, they separated and lost sight of each other. After a lapse of 20 years, this man's card came in one day, and Mr. Rogers had him brought into the private office. The man showed age, his clothes showed that he was not prosperous, and his speech and manner indicated that hard luck had soured him toward the world and the fates. He brought a bill against Mr. Rogers, oral in form, for $1,500, a bill 30 years old. Mr. Rogers drew the check and gave it to him, saying he could not allow him to lose it, though he almost deserved to lose it for risking the claim 30 years without presenting it. When he was gone, Mr. Rogers said, "My memory is better than his. I paid the money at the time. Knowing this, I know I took a receipt, although I do not remember that detail. To satisfy myself that I have not been careless, I will have that receipt searched out." It took a day or two, but it was found, and I saw it. Then it was sent back to its place again amongst the archives. Here follows that Boston sketch. Pen pictures of the big Standard Oil millionaire H. H. Rogers as he appeared during the present gas hearing. Boston has had the unique experience of having on the witness stand in court one of the wealthiest and brainiest men in this country. A man in the charmed inner circle of the very inner circle of the little ring of financial giants that make up the most powerful aggregation of wealth in this country. It has seen him for 4 days probed with an incessant volley of questions by one of the ablest lawyers in the Commonwealth, and it saw him step off the witness stand at the end as calm and serene and unruffled and fresh and vigorous as though he were 20 years younger than he is, and as though he had just finished a pleasure trip on his yacht, instead of having passed through what to most men would be an extremely trying ordeal. And for verbal fencing, Henry H. Rogers showed that he, by replies that were as quick as a flash and as impenetrable as adamant, is entitled to wear a crown of superiority over any witness examined in Massachusetts for many a day. When he had finished, the court had gleaned precious little about the case beyond what it had already learned from Mr. Windsor. Except for Mr. Rogers's version of the famous telephone conversation with Mr. Lawson. And that certainly is interesting in view of the fact that Mr. Lawson's understanding seems to have been quite different from Mr. Rogers's. This difference apparently throwing a sidelight upon the present relations between the two men that is interesting, to say the least. It is reported that Mr. Whipple, keen as he is, unrelenting in his pursuit of a fact, acknowledges that Mr. Rogers was the best fencer he ever met in his legal career. That he was enough for Mr. Whipple, sometimes a little too much, was the general opinion of those who saw the two cross swords. Mr. Rogers was ill soon after he came to Boston. Our east wind, or the smell of escaping gas with the lid partially off, or something else, was too much for him, and he took to his humble bed in Boston's Waldorf Astoria, or the nearest thing to it that the Hub possesses. There were some people who thought that meant he was going to dodge, that he would be too ill to testify and leave Boston in the lurch, just as a famous operatic star or an actress sometimes does. But the people who knew him said, "No, Mr. Rogers is no dodger. He is a fighter in the heavyweight championship class, and he will see it through." And he did. One afternoon, Mr. Windsor, after some 10 trying days on the witness stand, answered his last question, smiled his last smile to the court and spectators, and stepped down. The next morning, a few soups and players of minor parts came on and did their little turn. Then a tall, distinguished-looking gentleman, one bearing the mark of a leader among men, took the center of the stage, the witness box. For the first time, the crowd in the courtroom got a good look at the man of many millions as Mr. Rogers faced the questioning counsel. The court gave permission to the witness to sit while he gave his evidence in consideration of his recent illness. Mr. Rogers is all that his pictures represent him to be, and much, very much more. The first thing that almost anyone would notice is his head, a literal dome of thought, large, finely shaped, extraordinarily high above the line of the eyes, rounded and fully developed in the back, the head of a man with tremendous capacity for thought. A strong, forceful head, that of a man capable of planning and of executing his plans, distinctly the head of a man of affairs, of tremendous affairs. The head might attract more attention than the face, although the latter is clearly that of a man of high standing among men, clear-cut, almost ascetic in some of its lines, aggressive as to the chin, firm as to the mouth, keen as to the eyes. The gray, well-trimmed mustache, the alert, vigorous, trim, well-kept, well-groomed, well-set-up figure, impart a military air that fits perfectly upon this man of power. Mr. Whipple is ready to begin his bombardment of questions. Mr. Rogers sits at ease, his legs crossed, his arms upon the rails at the side of the witness box, his head thrown up and back, his eyes inscrutable, his whole demeanor that of waiting on the defense. He doesn't pose at all, apparently. Many men do in similar positions. Their whole attitude is one of consciousness of being looked at and of trying to look as impressive as possible. But Mr. Rogers isn't one of that sort. His attitudes fit him as well as the clothes he wears, and that is to perfection. Mr. Whipple asks the customary questions as to name, residence, etc. Then as to occupation, and as to this Mr. Rogers gives some inkling as to his baffling course as a witness. He admitted that he had been in the petroleum business for 40 years and said, "I'm trying to think if I've been in the gas business." Everybody laughs. Evidently Mr. Rogers is going to be a very amusing witness at times. Even Mr. Whipple, who can take a joke, even if it is on himself, smiles. And this smile of Mr. Rogers is worth seeing. It isn't any little, skimpy, cold, selfish, calculating smile, but the real, genuine Simon Pure article. It makes one think that Mr. Rogers, to those who have the privilege of knowing him well, might be a very pleasant, even a jolly, companion. Shakespeare says one may smile and be a villain, but it's hard to believe it if he smiles just as Mr. Rogers does. It isn't any smile that won't come off, however, for the next instant it has vanished and the keen, alert, waiting look has taken its place. During the first day, Mr. Rogers smiled quite often as he deftly parried his opponent's thrusts, but towards the end of that day, Mr. Whipple, who smiles the hardest when he is about to do his worst, got in a pretty good blow, and Mr. Rogers put on a serious and a rather annoyed look. Mr. Whipple wanted Mr. Rogers to produce a certain private correspondence book, and Mr. Rogers objected to doing this. Just as matters began to wax rather warm, the judge poured oil on the troubled waters by adjourning court. The next morning, Mr. Rogers, urbane and pleasant, produced the book. That was Friday, and court adjourned to Monday to give Mr. Whipple time to look over the book so as to use its contents to the best advantage. Monday morning, the siege of Mr. Rogers's citadel of knowledge of gas affairs was renewed by Mr. Whipple, and a full day was put in at questions and answers. Whether the court was enlightened much by the day's developments is not to be stated, but it is pretty certain that the public wasn't. The way Mr. Rogers parried questions that he didn't want to answer was well worth listening to. Here is a sample of it. Question. Were your relations with Mr. Addicks unfriendly in 1901? Answer. I cannot answer as to that. Question. Well, as to 1902? Answer. Oh, we had our differences. Tuesday was an unusually fruitful day as to interesting topics, at least. Time and again, when Mr. Whipple asked questions as to points on which Mr. Rogers's recollection was a bit hazy, the witness would refer counsel to his books and papers and memoranda, saying that if anything could be found in them bearing upon the matter at hand, he would be willing and even glad to have it produced. There were several smiles by the witness, the audience, and even the court during this day. At one time, Mr. Rogers smiled at some inward recollection aroused by the reading of a personal note to him from Mr. Windsor, following a trip the latter had had as Mr. Rogers's guest on the millionaire's yacht. This seemed to annoy Mr. Whipple. He walked up close to the witness and fired the question at short range, with briar points in his tone. "Why do you smile, Mr. Rogers?" "I smile because it is natural for me to smile," said Mr. Rogers, in his very pleasantest, most affable way. Talk about a soft answer turning away wrath. Mr. Rogers is a past master of that little trick, all right. Tuesday was the day Mr. Rogers told of the telephone conversation with Mr. Lawson. And in view of Mr. Lawson's version Friday last of the same conversation, Mr. Rogers's statement is well worth repeating. I called up Mr. Lawson on the telephone and asked him how he felt about this reorganization of the New England Gas and Coke Company. He said he felt very unpleasantly. I asked him how, and he recited some private grievances. Mr. Whipple, state what they were. Mr. Rogers. He said, you know how I feel towards Mr. Whitney and those other people down there who interfered with me in reference to the New York Yacht Club matter. If I were able, I'd rather lose $1 million than make any compromise with them. I told him if he felt in that frame of mind and preferred it to business, it was one thing. He asked me my judgment, and I told him that I thought it would be a wise thing for him to participate in the reorganization. He said, well, that's the way I feel about it, but I'm willing to be influenced by you and take your advice in the matter. I said, it is not for me to advise, it is for you to determine. He made some few remarks which I cannot recall, and finally said, well, what can I get? I said, I don't know, what do you want? He said, I think I ought to have 15% or 20% out of the profits of the reorganization. I said, that's pretty steep, considering that you are not to do much. He said, well, do the best you can. I'm willing to leave it to you. I went back and reported to Mr. Windsor that I thought Mr. Lawson would be glad to have an interest in the reorganization. Mr. Windsor asked, what interest does he want? I said, I thought he would like to have 15% or 20%. Mr. Windsor said, I think that is pretty steep for not doing very much. Well, I said, maybe it is a little too much, and it was finally settled that Mr. Lawson was to have 10% for the reorganization and any profits that came from his own securities. Mr. Windsor said it was all right, and we took a piece of paper out of my desk, and he wrote the memorandum, and I initialed it, giving the substance of the conversation with Mr. Lawson. Next morning, I told Mr. Lawson over the telephone of the arrangement, and he said it was all right. Another time that Mr. Rogers smiled and caused everybody within hearing to smile, too, was when he was telling on Thursday, his last day on the stand, and near the close of his evidence, of his scolding Mr. Addicks. Perhaps my words were somewhat emphatic, Mr. Rogers confessed to Mr. Whipple in a burst of confidence. Question. Let us see what you do say when you get emphatic with J. Edward Addicks and take him to task. Answer. Well, in the interest of courtesy and having a little modesty yet, I do not think I want to go into it further. Question. Did you use words to Mr. Addix that you do not care to repeat here? Answer. I must confess that at the time I was very positive. Laughter. In substance, I said that his letters, or that of his man, Senator Alley, were outrageous, and I wanted to know what he meant by having his man send them to me. He said he knew nothing about them, and I think that is all there was about the case. Question. Did you threaten Mr. Addix? Answer. Oh, no, I never threaten anybody. Laughter. Question. But you scolded him? Answer. We just had a little talk. It seems that sometimes I am not half as furious as I think I am. Laughter. Then Mr. Rogers smiled, not a grim smile either, but a sort of a happy, reminiscent smile, like that of a 10-year-old boy who remembers an extra piece of mince pie. Soon after that, Mr. Rogers stepped off the stand for good, bowed pleasantly to the newspaper men to whom he hardly ever failed to speak as he passed them, and left the courtroom. He certainly made one of the most entertaining witnesses Boston has heard in a long time. We shall be pleased to see you in a similar capacity again, Mr. Rogers. Heath. The following text is preserved in an untitled manuscript in the Mark Twain papers. Clemens labeled it Autobiog at the top of the first page, but he did not integrate it with the final text of the autobiography. Payne penciled a title on the first page of the manuscript, Anecdote of Jean, Her Love of Animals. The disaster portrayed in Jean's picture book occurred on the 1st of November, 1755, when a powerful series of earthquakes, followed by fires and a tsunami, destroyed much of Lisbon and killed an estimated 60,000 people and an unknown number of animals. The event became a focal point for debates on the nature of divine providence and was frequently depicted in works of art. Payne omitted this text from the autobiography, but in his biography of Clemens he retold the story, partly by paraphrasing this manuscript. The full text is printed here for the first time. Anecdote of Jean. February 20th, 05. Jean's deep love and tenderness for animals continues, and of course will always continue since it is a part of her temperament. Temperaments are born, not made, and they cannot be changed by time, nor training, nor by any other force. Katie has been recalling a beautiful incident apropos of this. When Jean was a little child, Katie was one day amusing her with a picture book. One picture represented the Lisbon earthquake. The earth was gaping open and the people were tumbling into the chasm. Jean was not interested. Katie turned to the next picture. The same earthquake, but this time it was the animals that were being swallowed up. Jean's eyes filled at once, and she said, "Poor things." Katie said, "Why, you didn't care for the people." Jean said, "Oh, they could speak." Autobiography of Mark Twain. An Early Attempt. The chapters which immediately follow constitute a fragment of one of my many attempts, after I was in my 40s, to put my life on paper. It starts out with good confidence, but suffers the fate of its brethren, is presently abandoned for some other and newer interest. This is not to be wondered at, for its plan is the old, 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 unflexible and difficult one, the plan that starts you at the cradle and drives you straight for the grave, with no side excursions permitted on the way, whereas the side excursions are the life of our life voyage, and should be also of its history. My autobiography. Random extracts from it. So much for the earlier days and the New England branch of the Clemenses. The other brother settled in the South and is remotely responsible for me. He has collected his reward generations ago, whatever it was. He went South with his particular friend Fairfax and settled in Maryland with him, but afterward went further and made his home in Virginia. This is the Fairfax whose descendants were to enjoy a curious distinction, that of being American-born English earls. The founder of the house was Lord General Fairfax of the Parliamentary Army in Cromwell's time. The earldom, which is of recent date, came to the American Fairfaxes through the failure of male heirs in England. Old residents of San Francisco will remember Charlie, the American earl of the mid-60s, 10th Lord Fairfax, according to Burke's Peerage, and holder of a modest public office of some sort or other in the new mining town of Virginia City, Nevada. He was never out of America. I knew him, but not intimately. He had a golden character, and that was all his fortune. He laid his title aside and gave it a holiday until his circumstances should improve to a degree consonant with its dignity, but that time never came, I think. He was a manly man and had fine generosities in his makeup. A prominent and pestilent creature named Ferguson, who was always picking quarrels with better men than himself, picked one with him one day, and Fairfax knocked him down. Ferguson gathered himself up and went off mumbling threats. Fairfax carried no arms and refused to carry any now, though his friends warned him that Ferguson was of a treacherous disposition and would be sure to take revenge by base means sooner or later. Nothing happened for several days. Then Ferguson took the Earl by surprise and snapped a revolver at his breast. Fairfax wrenched the pistol from him and was going to shoot him, but the man fell on his knees and begged and said, "Don't kill me, I have a wife and children." Fairfax was in a towering passion, but the appeal reached his heart, and he said, "They have done me no harm," and he let the rascal go. Back of the Virginian Clemenses is a dim procession of ancestors stretching back to Noah's time. According to tradition, some of them were pirates and slavers in Elizabeth's time. But this is no discredit to them, for so were Drake and Hawkins and the others. It was a respectable trade then, and monarchs were partners in it. In my time, I have had desires to be a pirate myself. The reader, if he will look deep down in his secret heart, will find, but never mind what he will find there. I am not writing his autobiography, but mine. Later, according to tradition, one of the procession was ambassador to Spain in the time of James I, or of Charles I, and married there and sent down a strain of Spanish blood to warm us up. Also, according to tradition, this one or another, Geoffrey Clement by name, helped to sentence Charles to death. I have not examined into these traditions myself, partly because I was indolent and partly because I was so busy polishing up this end of the line and trying to make it showy. But the other Clemenses claim that they have made the examination and that it stood the test. Therefore, I have always taken for granted that I did help Charles out of his troubles by ancestral proxy. My instincts have persuaded me, too. Whenever we have a strong and persistent and ineradicable instinct, we may be sure that it is not original with us, but inherited. Inherited from a way back and hardened and perfected by the petrifying influence of time. Now, I have been always and unchangingly bitter against Charles, and I am quite certain that this feeling trickled down to me through the veins of my forebears from the heart of that judge. For it is not my disposition to be bitter against people on my own personal account. I am not bitter against Jeffreys. I ought to be, but I am not. It indicates that my ancestors of James II's time were indifferent to him. I do not know why. I never could make it out. But that is what it indicates. And I have always felt friendly toward Satan. Of course, that is ancestral. It must be in the blood, for I could not have originated it. And so, by the testimony of instinct, backed by the assertions of Clemenses who said they had examined the records, I have always been obliged to believe that Geoffrey Clement the Martyr Maker was an ancestor of mine, and to regard him with favor, and in fact pride. This has not had a good effect upon me, for it has made me vain, and that is a fault. It has made me set myself above people who are less fortunate in their ancestry than I, and has moved me to take them down a peg upon occasion and say things to them which hurt them before company. A case of the kind happened in Berlin several years ago. William Walter Phelps was our minister at the Emperor's court then, and one evening he had me to dinner to meet Count S., a cabinet minister. This nobleman was of long and illustrious descent. Of course, I wanted to let out the fact that I had some ancestors, too, but I did not want to pull them out of their graves by the ears, and I never could seem to get a chance to work them in a way that would look sufficiently casual. I suppose Phelps was in the same difficulty. In fact, he looked distraught now and then, just as a person looks who wants to uncover an ancestor purely by accident and cannot think of a way that will seem accidental enough. But at last, after dinner, he made a try. He took us about his drawing room, showing us the pictures, and finally stopped before a rude and ancient engraving. It was a picture of the court that tried Charles I. There was a pyramid of judges in Puritan slouch hats, and below them three bareheaded secretaries seated at a table. Mr. Phelps put his finger upon one of the three and said with exulting indifference, "An ancestor of mine." I put my finger on a judge and retorted with scathing languidness, "Ancestor of mine, but it is a small matter. I have others." It was not noble in me to do it. I have always regretted it since. but it landed him. I wonder how he felt. However, it made no difference in our friendship, which shows that he was fine and high, notwithstanding the humbleness of his origin. And it was also creditable in me, too, that I could overlook it. I made no change in my bearing toward him, but always treated him as an equal. But it was a hard night for me in one way. Mr. Phelps thought I was the guest of honor, and so did Count S., but I didn't, for there was nothing in my invitation to indicate it. It was just a friendly offhand note on a card. By the time dinner was announced, Phelps was himself in a state of doubt. Something had to be done, and it was not a handy time for explanations. He tried to get me to go out with him, but I held back. Then he tried S., and he also declined. There was another guest, but there was no trouble about him. We finally went out in a pile. There was a decorous plunge for seats, and I got the one at Mr. Phelps's left. The Count captured the one facing Phelps, and the other guest had to take the place of honor, since he could not help himself. We returned to the drawing-room in the original disorder. I had new shoes on, and they were tight. At 11 I was privately crying. I couldn't help it, the pain was so cruel. Conversation had been dead for an hour. S. had been due at the bedside of a dying official ever since 9:30. At last we all rose by one blessed impulse and went down to the street door without explanations, in a pile, and no precedence, and so parted. The evening had its defects. Still, I got my ancestor in, and was satisfied. Among the Virginian Clemenses were Jeremiah, already mentioned, and Sherrard. Jeremiah Clemens had a wide reputation as a good pistol shot, and once it enabled him to get on the friendly side of some drummers when they would not have paid any attention to mere smooth words and arguments. He was out stumping the state at the time. The drummers were grouped in front of the stand, and had been hired by the opposition to drum while he made his speech. When he was ready to begin, he got out his revolver and laid it before him, and said in his soft, silky way, "I do not wish to hurt anybody, and shall not try to, but I have got just a bullet apiece for those 6 drums, and if you should want to play on them, don't stand behind them." Sherrard Clemens was a Republican congressman from West Virginia in the war days, and then went out to St. Louis, where the James Clemens branch lived, and still lives, and there he became a warm rebel. This was after the war. At the time that he was a Republican, I was a rebel, but by the time he had become a rebel, I was become, temporarily, a Republican. The Clemenses have always done the best they could to keep the political balances level, no matter how much it might inconvenience them. I did not know what had become of Sherrard Clemens, but once I introduced Senator Hawley to a Republican mass meeting in New England, and then I got a bitter letter from Sherrard from St. Louis. He said that the Republicans of the North, no, the Mudsills of the North, had swept away the old aristocracy of the South with fire and sword, and it ill became me, an aristocrat by blood, to train with that kind of swine. Did I forget that I was a Lambton? That was a reference to my mother's side of the house. As I have already said, she was a Lambton, L-A-M-B-T-O-N, Lambton with a P, L-A-M-P-T-O-N, for some of the American Lamptons could not spell very well in early times, and so the name suffered at their hands. She was a native of Kentucky and married my father in Lexington in 1823, when she was 20 years old and he 24. Neither of them had an overplus of property. She brought him 2 or 3 Negroes, but nothing else, I think. They removed to the remote and secluded village of Jamestown in the mountain solitudes of East Tennessee. There their first crop of children was born, but as I was of a later vintage, I do not remember anything about it. I was postponed to Missouri. Missouri was an unknown new state and needed attractions. I think that my eldest brother, Orion, my sisters Pamela and Margaret, and my brother Benjamin were born in Jamestown. There may have been others, but as to that, I'm not sure. It was a great lift for that little village to have my parents come there. It was hoped that they would stay, so that it would become a city. It was supposed that they would stay, and so there was a boom. But by and by they went away, and prices went down, and it was many years before Jamestown got another start. I have written about Jamestown in The Gilded Age, a book of mine, but it was from hearsay, not from personal knowledge. My father left a fine estate behind him in the region round about Jamestown, 75,000 acres. Correction, 1906, it was above 100,000, it appears. When he died in 1847, he had owned it about 20 years. The taxes were almost nothing, $5 a year for the whole, and he had always paid them regularly and kept his title perfect. He had always said that the land would not become valuable in his time, but that it would be a commodious provision for his children some day. It contained coal, copper, iron, and timber, and he said that in the course of time railways would pierce to that region, and then the property would be property in fact as well as in name. It also produced a wild grape of a promising sort. He had sent some samples to Nicholas Longworth of Cincinnati to get his judgment upon them, and Mr. Longworth had said that they would make as good wine as his Catawbas. The land contained all these riches, and also oil, but my father did not know that, and of course in those early days he would have cared nothing about it if he had known it. The oil was not discovered until about 1895. I wish I owned a couple of acres of the land now, in which case I would not be writing autobiographies for a living. My father's dying charge was, "Cling to the land and wait. Let nothing beguile it away from you." My mother's favorite cousin, James Lambton, who figures in the Gilded Age as Colonel Sellers, always said of that land, and said it with blazing enthusiasm, too, "There's millions in it. Millions." It is true that he always said that about everything, and was always mistaken, too, but this time he was right, which shows that a man who goes around with a prophecy gun ought never to get discouraged. If he will keep up his heart and fire at everything he sees, he is bound to hit something by and by. Many persons regarded Colonel Sellers as a fiction, an invention, an extravagant impossibility, and did me the honor to call him a creation, but they were mistaken. I merely put him on paper as he was. He was not a person who could be exaggerated. The incidents which looked most extravagant, both in the book and on the stage, were not inventions of mine, but were facts of his life, and I was present when they were developed. John T. Raymond's audiences used to come near to dying with laughter over the turnip-eating scene, but extravagant as the scene was, it was faithful to the facts in all its absurd details. The thing happened in Lambton's own house, and I was present. In fact, I was myself the guest who ate the turnips. In the hands of a great actor, that piteous scene would have dimmed any manly spectator's eyes with tears and racked his ribs apart with laughter at the same time. But Raymond was great in humorous portrayal only. In that he was superb, he was wonderful. In a word, great. In all things else, he was a pygmy of the pygmies. The real Colonel Sellers, as I knew him in James Lambton, was a pathetic and beautiful spirit, a manly man, a straight and honorable man, a man with a big, foolish, unselfish heart in his bosom, a man born to be loved. And he was loved by all his friends and by his family, worshipped. It is the right word. To them he was but little less than a god. The real Colonel Sellers was never on the stage. Only half of him was there. Raymond could not play the other half of him. It was above his level. That half was made up of qualities of which Raymond was wholly destitute. For Raymond was not a manly man. He was not an honorable man, nor an honest one. He was empty and selfish and vulgar and ignorant and silly, and there was a vacancy in him where his heart should have been. There was only one man who could have played the whole of Colonel Sellers, and that was Frank Mayo. Raymond was playing Colonel Sellers in about 1876 and along there. About 20 years later, Mayo dramatized Pudd'nhead Wilson and played the title role very delightfully. It is a world of surprises. They fall, too, where one is least expecting them. When I introduced Sellers into the book, Charles Dudley Warner, who was writing the story with me, proposed a change of Sellers' Christian name. 10 years before, in a remote corner of the West, he had come across a man named Eskel Sellers, and he thought that Eskel was just the right and fitting name for our Sellers, since it was odd and quaint and all that. I liked the idea, but I said that that man might turn up and object. But Warner said it couldn't happen. That he was doubtless dead by this time. A man with a name like that couldn't live long. And be he dead or alive, we must have the name. It was exactly the right one, and we couldn't do without it. So the change was made. Warner's man was a farmer in a cheap and humble way. When the book had been out a week, a college-bred gentleman of courtly manners and ducal upholstery arrived in Hartford in a sultry state of mind and with a libel suit in his eye, and his name was Eskel Sellers. He had never heard of the other one, and had never been within 1,000 miles of him. This damaged aristocrat's program was quite definite and businesslike. The American Publishing Company must suppress the edition as far as printed and change the name in the plates or stand a suit for $10,000. He carried away the company's promise and many apologies, and we changed the name back to Colonel Mulberry Sellers in the plates. Apparently there is nothing that cannot happen, even the existence of two unrelated men wearing the impossible name of Estelle Sellers is a possible thing. James Lambton floated all his days in a tinted mist of magnificent dreams and died at last without seeing one of them realized. I saw him last in 1884, when it had been 26 years since I ate the basin of raw turnips and washed them down with a bucket of water in his house. He was become old and white-headed, but he entered to me in the same old breezy way of his earlier life, and he was all there yet, not a detail wanting. The happy light in his eye, the abounding hope in his heart, the persuasive tongue, the miracle-breeding imagination, they were all there. And before I could turn around, he was polishing up his Aladdin's lamp and flashing the secret riches of the world before me. I said to myself, I did not overdraw him by a shade. I set him down as he was, and he is the same man today. Cable will recognize him. I asked him to excuse me a moment and ran into the next room, which was Cable's. Cable and I were stumping the Union on a reading tour. I said, I'm going to leave your door open so that you can listen. There is a man in there who is interesting. I went back and asked Lambton what he was doing now. He began to tell me of a small venture he had begun in New Mexico through his son. Only a little thing, a mere trifle, partly to amuse my leisure, partly to keep my capital from lying idle, but mainly to develop the boy. Develop the boy. Fortune's wheel is ever revolving. He may have to work for his living some day. The strange things have happened in this world. But it's only a little thing, a mere trifle, as I said. And so it was, as he began it. But under his deft hands it grew and blossomed and spread, oh, beyond imagination. At the end of half an hour he finished with this remark, uttered in an adorably languid manner. Yes, it is but a trifle as things go nowadays, a bagatelle, but amusing. It passes the time. The boy thinks great things of it, but he is young, you know, and imaginative. Lacks the experience which comes of handling large affairs, and which tempers the fancy and perfects the judgment. I suppose there's a couple of millions in it, possibly three, but not more, I think. Still, for a boy, you know, just starting in life, it is not bad. I should not want him to make a fortune. Let that come later. It could turn his head at his time of life, and in many ways be a damage to him. Then he said something about his having left his pocketbook lying on the table in the main drawing room at home, and about its being after banking hours now, and I stopped in there and begged him to honor Cable and me by being our guest at the lecture, with as many friends as might be willing to do us the like honor. He accepted, and he thanked me as a prince might who had granted us a grace. The reason I stopped his speech about the tickets was because I saw that he was going to ask me to furnish them to him and let him pay next day. And I knew that if he made the debt, he would pay it if he had to pawn his clothes. After a little further chat, he shook hands heartily and affectionately and took his leave. Cable put his head in at the door and said, "That was Colonel Sellers." Chapter. As I have said, that vast plot of Tennessee land, 100,000 acres, was held by my father 20 years, intact. When he died in 1847, we began to manage it ourselves. 40 years afterward, we had managed it all away except 10,000 acres and gotten nothing to remember the sales by. About 1887, possibly it was earlier, the 10,000 went. My brother found a chance to trade it for a house and lot in the town of Corry in the oil regions of Pennsylvania. About 1894, he sold this property for $250. That ended the Tennessee land. If any penny of cash ever came out of my father's wise investment but that, I have no recollection of it. No, I am overlooking a detail. It furnished me a field for sellers and a book. Out of my half of the book, I got $15,000 or $20,000. Out of the play, I got $75,000 or $80,000, just about a dollar an acre. It is curious. I was not alive when my father made the investment, therefore he was not intending any partiality. Yet I was the only member of the family that ever profited by it. I shall have occasion to mention this land again now and then as I go along, for it influenced our life in one way or another during more than a generation. Whenever things grew dark, it rose and put out its hopeful seller's hand and cheered us up and said, "Do not be afraid. Trust in me. Wait." It kept us hoping and hoping during 40 years and forsook us at last. It put our energies to sleep and made visionaries of us, dreamers and indolent. We were always going to be rich next year. No occasion to work. It is good to begin life poor. It is good to begin life rich. These are wholesome. But to begin it prospectively rich, the man who has not experienced it cannot imagine the curse of it. My parents removed to Missouri in the early 30s. I do not remember just when, for I was not born then and cared nothing for such things. It was a long journey in those days and must have been a rough and tiresome one. The home was made in the wee village of Florida in Monroe County, and I was born there in 1835. The village contained 100 people, and I increased the population by 1%. It is more than the best man in history ever did for any other town. It may not be modest in me to refer to this, but it is true. There is no record of a person doing as much, not even Shakespeare. But I did it for Florida, and it shows that I could have done it for any place, even London, I suppose. Recently, someone in Missouri has sent me a picture of the house I was born in. Heretofore, I have always stated that it was a palace, but I shall be more guarded now. I remember only one circumstance connected with my life in it. I remember it very well, though I was but 2.5 years old at the time. The family packed up everything and started in wagons for Hannibal on the Mississippi, 30 miles away. Toward night, when they camped and counted up the children, one was missing. I was the one. I'd been left behind. Parents ought always to count the children before they start. I was having a good enough time playing by myself until I found that the doors were fastened and that there was a grisly, deep silence brooding over the place. I knew then that the family were gone and that they had forgotten me. I was well frightened, and I made all the noise I could, but no one was near, and it did no good. I spent the afternoon in captivity and was not rescued till the gloaming had fallen and the place was alive with ghosts. My brother Henry was 6 months old at that time. I used to remember his walking into a fire outdoors when he was a week old. It was remarkable in me to remember a thing like that, which occurred when I was so young. And it was still more remarkable that I should cling to the delusion for 30 years that I did remember it, for of course it never happened. He would not have been able to walk at that age. If I had stopped to reflect, I should not have burdened my memory with that impossible rubbish so long. It is believed by many people that an impression deposited in a child's memory within the first 2 years of its life cannot remain there 5 years, but that is an error. The incident of Benvenuto Cellini and the salamander must be accepted as authentic and trustworthy. And then that remarkable and indisputable instance in the experience of Helen Keller. However, I will speak of that at another time. For many years I believed that I remembered helping my grandfather drink his whiskey toddy when I was 6 weeks old. But I do not tell about that any more now. I am grown old, and my memory is not as active as it used to be. When I was younger, I could remember anything, whether it had happened or not. But my faculties are decaying now, and soon I shall be so I cannot remember any but the latter. It is sad to go to pieces like this, but we all have to do it. My uncle, John A. Quarles, was a farmer, and his place was in the country 4 miles from Florida. He had 8 children, and 15 or 20 Negroes, and was also fortunate in other ways, particularly in his character. I have not come across a better man than he was. I was his guest for 2 or 3 months every year, from the 4th year after we removed to Hannibal till I was 11 or 12 years old. I have never consciously used him or his wife in a book, but his farm has come in very handy to me in literature once or twice. In Huck Finn and in Tom Sawyer Detective, I moved it down to Arkansas. It was all of 600 miles, but it was no trouble. It was not a very large farm. 500 acres, perhaps, but I could have done it if it had been twice as large. And as for the morality of it, I cared nothing for that. I would move a state if the exigencies of literature required it. It was a heavenly place for a boy, that farm of my Uncle John's. The house was a double log one, with a spacious floor, roofed in, connecting it with the kitchen. In the summer, the table was set in the middle of that shady and breezy floor, and the sumptuous meals, well, it makes me cry to think of them. Fried chicken, roast pig, wild and tame turkeys, ducks and geese, venison just killed, squirrels, rabbits, pheasants, partridges, prairie chickens, homemade bacon and ham, hot biscuits, hot batter cakes, hot buckwheat cakes, hot wheat bread, hot rolls, hot corn pone. fresh corn boiled on the ear, succotash, butter beans, string beans, tomatoes, peas, Irish potatoes, sweet potatoes, buttermilk, sweet milk, clabber, watermelons, musk melons, cantaloupes, all fresh from the garden, apple pie, peach pie, pumpkin pie, apple dumplings, peach cobbler. I can't remember the rest. The way that the things were cooked was perhaps the main splendor, particularly a certain few of the dishes. For instance, the cornbread, the hot biscuits and wheat bread, and the fried chicken. These things have never been properly cooked in the North. In fact, no one there is able to learn the art, so far as my experience goes. The North thinks it knows how to make cornbread, but this is gross superstition. Perhaps no bread in the world is quite as good as Southern cornbread, and perhaps no bread in the world is quite so bad as the Northern imitation of it. The North seldom tries to fry chicken, and this as well. The art cannot be learned north of the line of Mason and Dixon, nor anywhere in Europe. This is not hearsay, it is experience that is speaking. In Europe, it is imagined that the custom of serving various kinds of bread blazing hot is American, but that is too broad a spread. It is custom in the South, but it is much less than that in the North. In the North and in Europe, hot bread is considered unhealthy. This is probably another fussy superstition, like the European superstition that ice water is unhealthy. Europe does not need ice water and does not drink it. And yet, notwithstanding this, its word for it is better than ours because it describes it, whereas ours doesn't. Europe calls it iced water. Our word describes water made from melted ice, a drink which has a characterless taste and which we have but little acquaintance with. It seems a pity that the world should throw away so many good things merely because they are unwholesome. I doubt if God has given us any refreshment which, taken in moderation, is unwholesome, except microbes. Yet there are people who strictly deprive themselves of each and every eatable, drinkable, and smokable which has in any way acquired a shady reputation. They pay this price for health, and health is all they get for it. How strange it is! It is like paying out your whole fortune for a cow that has gone dry. The farmhouse stood in the middle of a very large yard, and the yard was fenced on three sides with rails and on the rear side with high palings. Against these stood the smokehouse. Beyond the palings was the orchard. Beyond the orchard were the negro quarter and the tobacco fields. The front yard was entered over a stile made of sawed-off logs of graduated heights. I do not remember any gate. In a corner of the front yard were a dozen lofty hickory trees and a dozen black walnuts, and in the nutting season riches were to be gathered there. Down a piece, abreast the house, stood a little log cabin against the rail fence, and there the woody hill fell sharply away, past the barns, the corn crib, the stables, and the tobacco-curing house, to a limpid brook which sang along over its gravelly bed and curved and frisked in and out and here and there and yonder in the deep shade of overhanging foliage and vines. A divine place for wading, and it had swimming pools, too, which were forbidden to us and therefore much frequented by us, for we were little Christian children and had early been taught the value of forbidden fruit. In the little log cabin lived a bedridden, white-headed slave woman whom we visited daily and looked upon with awe. For we believed she was upwards of 1,000 years old and had talked with Moses. The younger negroes credited these statistics and had furnished them to us in good faith. We accommodated all the details which came to us about her, and so we believed that she had lost her health in the long desert trip coming out of Egypt and had never been able to get it back again. She had a round, bald place on the crown of her head, and we used to creep around and gaze at it in reverent silence, and reflect that it was caused by fright through seeing Pharaoh drowned. We called her Aunt Hannah, Southern fashion. She was superstitious like the other negroes. Also like them, she was deeply religious. Like them, she had great faith in prayer, and employed it in all ordinary exigencies, but not in cases where a dead certainty of result was urgent. Whenever witches were around, she tied up the remnant of her wool in little tufts with white thread, and this promptly made the witches impotent. All the negroes were friends of ours, and with those of our own age we were in effect comrades. I say in effect, using the phrase as a modification. We were comrades and yet not comrades. Color and condition interposed a subtle line which both parties were conscious of, and which rendered complete fusion impossible. We had a faithful and affectionate good friend, ally, and adviser in Uncle Dan'l, a middle-aged slave whose head was the best one in the negro quarter, whose sympathies were wide and warm, and whose heart was honest and simple and knew no guile. He has served me well these many, many years. I have not seen him for more than half a century, and yet spiritually I have had his welcome company a good part of that time, and have staged him in books under his own name and as Jim, and carted him all around, to Hannibal, down the Mississippi on a raft, and even across the desert of Sahara in a balloon. And he has endured it all with the patience and friendliness and loyalty which were his birthright. It was on the farm that I got my strong liking for his race and my appreciation of certain of its fine qualities. This feeling and this estimate have stood the test of 60 years and more, and have suffered no impairment. The black face is as welcome to me now as it was then. In my schoolboy days I had no aversion to slavery. I was not aware that there was anything wrong about it. No one arraigned it in my hearing. The local papers said nothing against it. The local pulpit taught us that God approved it, that it was a holy thing, and that the doubter need only look in the Bible if he wished to settle his mind. And then the texts were read aloud to us to make the matter sure. If the slaves themselves had an aversion to slavery, they were wise and said nothing. In Hannibal, we seldom saw a slave misused. On the farm, never. There was, however, one small incident of my boyhood days which touched this matter, and it must have meant a good deal to me, or it would not have stayed in my memory, clear and sharp, vivid and shadowless, all these slow-drifting years. We had a little slave boy whom we had hired from someone there in Hannibal. He was from the eastern shore of Maryland, and had been brought away from his family and his friends halfway across the American continent and sold. He was a cheery spirit, innocent and gentle, and the noisiest creature that ever was, perhaps. All day long he was singing, whistling, yelling, whooping, laughing. It was maddening, devastating, unendurable. At last one day I lost all my temper and went raging to my mother and said Sandy had been singing for an hour without a single break, and I couldn't stand it, and wouldn't she please shut him up? The tears came into her eyes and her lip trembled, and she said something like this, "Poor thing. When he sings, it shows that he is not remembering, and that comforts me. But when he is still, I am afraid he is thinking, and I cannot bear it. He will never see his mother again. If he can sing, I must not hinder it, but be thankful for it. If you were older, you would understand me. Then that friendless child's noise would make you glad." It was a simple speech, and made up of small words, but it went home, and Sandy's noise was not a trouble to me any more. She never used large words, but she had a natural gift for making small ones do effective work. She lived to reach the neighborhood of 90 years and was capable with her tongue to the last, especially when a meanness or an injustice roused her spirit. She has come handy to me several times in my books where she figures as Tom Sawyer's Aunt Polly. I fitted her out with a dialect and tried to think up other improvements for her, but did not find any. I used Sandy once also. It was in Tom Sawyer. I tried to get him to whitewash the fence, but it did not work. I do not remember what name I called him by in the book. I can see the farm yet with perfect clearness. I can see all its belongings, all its details. The family room of the house with a trundle bed in one corner and a spinning wheel in another. A wheel whose rising and falling wail, heard from a distance, was the mournfulest of all sounds to me, and made me homesick and low-spirited, and filled my atmosphere with the wandering spirits of the dead. The vast fireplace, piled high on winter nights with flaming hickory logs, from whose ends a sugary sap bubbled out, but did not go to waste, for we scraped it off and ate it. The lazy cat spread out on the rough hearthstones, the drowsy dogs braced against the jambs and blinking, my aunt in one chimney corner knitting, my uncle in the other smoking his corncob pipe, the slick and carpetless oak floor faintly mirroring the dancing flame tongues and freckled with black indentations where fire coals had popped out and died a leisurely death. Half a dozen children romping in the background twilight, split-bottomed chairs here and there, some with rockers, a cradle, out of service but waiting with confidence. In the early cold mornings, a snuggle of children in shirts and chemises, occupying the hearthstone and procrastinating. They could not bear to leave that comfortable place and go out on the windswept floor space between house and kitchen, where the general tin basin stood, and wash. Along outside of the front fence ran the country road, dusty in the summertime and a good place for snakes. They liked to lie in it and sun themselves. When they were rattlesnakes or puff adders, we killed them. When they were black snakes or racers or belonged to the fabled hoop breed, we fled without shame. When they were house snakes or garters, we carried them home and put them in Aunt Patsy's work basket for a surprise, for she was prejudiced against snakes, and always when she took the basket in her lap and they began to climb out of it, it disordered her mind. She never could seem to get used to them. Her opportunities went for nothing. And she was always cold toward bats, too, and could not bear them. And yet I think a bat is as friendly a bird as there is. My mother was Aunt Patsy's sister and had the same wild superstitions. A bat is beautifully soft and silky. I do not know any creature that is pleasanter to the touch or is more grateful for caressings if offered in the right spirit. I know all about these coleoptera because our great cave 3 miles below Hannibal was multitudinously stocked with them. And often I brought them home to amuse my mother with. It was easy to manage if it was a school day because then I had ostensibly been to school and hadn't any bats. She was not a suspicious person, but full of trust and confidence, and when I said, "There's something in my coat pocket for you," she would put her hand in, but she always took it out again herself. I didn't have to tell her. It was remarkable the way she couldn't learn to like private bats. The more experience she had, the more she could not change her views. I think she was never in the cave in her life, but everybody else went there. Many excursion parties came from considerable distances up and down the river to visit the cave. It was miles in extent, and was a tangled wilderness of narrow and lofty clefts and passages. It was an easy place to get lost in. Anybody could do it, including the bats. I got lost in it myself, along with a lady, and our last candle burned down to almost nothing before we glimpsed the search party's lights winding about in the distance. Injun Joe, the half-breed, got lost in there once and would have starved to death if the bats had run short. But there was no chance of that. There were myriads of them. He told me all his story. In the book called Tom Sawyer, I starved him entirely to death in the cave, but that was in the interest of art. It never happened. General Gaines, who was our first town drunkard before Jimmy Finn got the place, was lost in there for the space of a week and finally pushed his handkerchief out of a hole in a hilltop near Saverton, several miles down the river from the cave's mouth, and somebody saw it and dug him out. There is nothing the matter with his statistics except the handkerchief. I knew him for years, and he hadn't any. But it could have been his nose. That would attract attention. The cave was an uncanny place, for it contained a corpse, the corpse of a young girl of 14. It was in a glass cylinder enclosed in a copper one, which was suspended from a rail which bridged a narrow passage. The body was preserved in alcohol, and it was said that loafers and rowdies used to drag it up by the hair and look at the dead face. The girl was the daughter of a St. Louis surgeon of extraordinary ability and wide celebrity. He was an eccentric man and did many strange things. He put the poor thing in that forlorn place himself. He was a physician as well as a surgeon, and sometimes in cases where medicines failed to save, he developed other resources. He fell out once with a family whose physician he was, and after that they ceased to employ him. But a time came when he was once more called. The lady of the house was very ill, and had been given up by her doctors. He came into the room and stopped and stood still and looked around upon the scene. He had his great slouch hat on and a quarter of an acre of gingerbread under his arm, and while he looked meditatively about, he broke hunks from his cake, munched them, and let the crumbs dribble down his breast to the floor. The lady lay pale and still, with her eyes closed. About the bed in the solemn hush were grouped the family, softly sobbing, some standing, some kneeling. Presently the doctor began to take up the medicine bottles and sniff at them contemptuously and throw them out of the open window. When they were all gone, he ranged up to the bed, laid his slab of gingerbread on the dying woman's breast, and said roughly, "What are you idiots sniveling about? There's nothing the matter with this humbug. Put out your tongue." The sobbings stopped, and the angry mourners changed their attitudes and began to upbraid the doctor for his cruel behavior in this chamber of death. But he interrupted them with an explosion of profane abuse and said, "A pack of snuffling fatwits, do you think you can teach me my business? I tell you there is nothing the matter with the woman, nothing the matter but laziness. What she wants is a beefsteak and a washtub. With her damned society training, she..." Then the dying woman rose up in bed, and the light of battle was in her eye. She poured out upon the doctor her whole insulted mind. Just a volcanic eruption, accompanied by thunder and lightning, whirlwinds and earthquakes, pumice stone and ashes. It brought the reaction which he was after, and she got well. This was the lamented Dr. McDowell, whose name was so great and so honored in the Mississippi Valley a decade before the Civil War.